people are now respecting sleep much more than they used to.
Yeah, I think they're starting to wrap their head around the idea that it's not about feeling tired. You know, it's not just being sleepy and being low energy. It's really about like cognitive function and how efficient you can be in certain tasks and decision making and emotional intelligence. Like it's things that are subconscious, right? Like the things that are really impacted by sleep are like things like your reaction time, your ability to read people's faces, even like your facial expressions and matching your emotion. Like that stuff you can't like out tough, or you can't push through, or you know, try to act like it's not affecting you. Sleep is a tool in a way that's unlike any other, where it's really just making you better and more efficient, and like you said, optimizing these different portions of your life. It's not about feeling tired and having energy. It's about literally like becoming like the most streamlined, efficient version of yourself.
Before we dive into today's episode, I want to thank you for tuning in and supporting the brand. Now, I have spent the last decade plus of my life building Bear Performance Nutrition, and we create effective supplements that you can trust to support your wellness, endurance, and performance goals. We offer high quality, great tasting whey protein powders, effective pre-workouts, superfoods, sleep support, electrolytes, and much more. So if you want to support the content that we produce and the message that I am sharing through my content and on this podcast, I would greatly appreciate it if you went to bpnsups.com and you can use code NICKBEAR10 to save 10% off your next order. So thank you guys. I appreciate you. And let's dive into the show. Today on the podcast, we have Todd Anderson, who recently moved to Nashville a few months prior to me moving, all settled in. You've been a warm welcome here to the Nashville area. You've let me use your sauna, your cold plunge. You've optimized my sleep. A lot of things I want to talk about today, but welcome.
Yeah, appreciate it, man. I mean, that's Nashville for you. I feel like it's the most welcoming city there is.
It's been so welcoming.
I will say this has probably been the best year of my life, and a lot has to do with just the community of the city.
And you've lived all over the place.
Yeah, St. Louis, Naples, Miami, Chicago, New York, you know, Detroit. So pretty much the whole East Coast, I feel like. And it's it feels unlike anywhere else I've ever lived, for sure.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about a lot in this conversation, in this podcast. But before we dive into it, I do want to give some context into your background. Yeah. And I thought the best way to kick off that context is to explain the walk on mentality, the mindset. You have walk on tattoo on your body.
I do. It's on my wrist. It's a recent tattoo.
Similar to the way that I have going.
Yeah, I realized that after I got it when you were moving here. I saw it and I was like, oh, it's like the same exact spot.
It's a great spot for a tattoo. You always see it.
Always see it. It's actually in the Michigan State jersey font.
Love that.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like it's just a reminder myself that I feel like, you know, when you really like push the envelope and push the limits of what you're trying to do, like even physically, but also from a business perspective and just opportunities, I feel like there's so many times I feel so out of place and uncomfortable, you know, and have this imposter type feeling that like I don't deserve to be here or be in this room or, you know, have this platform, be on this stage. And, you know, it's just a reminder that like, that's how it's been my whole life. You know, I've like my mantra has been to put myself in situations and be around people that exceed my abilities or capabilities or talent level, whatever it is. And eventually you adapt to those surroundings. So I think a lot of people, you know, when they're a walk on and they kind of earn their way, you know, that's what it's about, is like earning the jersey, we used to say, but it's kind of just like earning your place. But in the same breath, it's a reminder that if you're doing the right things, you're going to feel pretty uncomfortable. And often, and a lot of times you're going to feel almost like insecure and have this imposter type feeling, because it takes a while for you to recognize that you belong there. And sometimes it takes a while for you to earn your place and earn your right to be there. But it's just a little constant reminder, a little subtle nudge when I'm, you know, feeling a certain way.
Yeah. And that all started when you walked on to Michigan State.
Yeah.
On the football team.
Yeah. It was by far the hardest thing I've done, you know, mentally, physically, but it was a dream come true. And I can't even say it was a dream come true, because up until 6 months before I actually went to Michigan State, it wasn't even in the universe of possibilities. Like, it was so far-fetched that, you know, it was similar to me just saying, like, I'm going to be the CEO of Tesla next year. Like, it's never going to happen. Like, it's not even on my mind, because I thought there was a 0% chance anything like that could ever happen.
And, I know we talked about this at dinner.
Yeah.
But I'd love to, like, share more of the story with the audience.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, I think another thing is just like saying yes to every opportunity has served me so well in life. And the more things I say yes to, the more good things just seem to happen. And this is an example. Like, so I was pretty set to go to a Division III school and play football, maybe football and baseball. Baseball is my best sport. And the summer before my senior year, I happened to jump into a 7-on-7 during the summer. So we were playing 7-on-7, and I was a lineman and linebacker, so I didn't even do 7-on-7, but I just showed up to kind of support our team, like, you know, watch our quarterbacks throw, whatever. And my dad was an assistant coach, so I just showed up and to hang out with the team. And our tight end didn't show up, and I never played tight end, but, you know, I had been, you know, lifting before school. I got myself in, like, significantly better shape than I'd ever been in, jumped in at tight end, and I made a couple of one-handed catches, and just had a really good day. And this was at Jackson High, which is the biggest school in Michigan. So their head coach happened to see me make a couple catches. All right. So fast forward to May of the following year. Like, I'm going to school in less than 6 months. Michigan State had a new coaching staff, and their coach went to Jackson High to see, hey, do you have anyone that potentially, we have a couple walk-on spots available, anybody that would be interested? And the coach is like, I don't have anybody at that level, but if you should talk to anybody in the county, go talk to Todd Anderson at Napoleon High School. And I'm from, like, the smallest high school. Nobody's ever played Division I football. I don't know if anybody's really played Division II football from my high school. Like, we had bring your tractor to school day. That's how small of a school we're talking about.
So, like, out in the country.
Oh, in the country. Yeah, I had a John Deere shirt. I had a cowboy hat in my seventh grade football picture. And, you know, I grew up going to Michigan State games with my dad. My dad used to work in the recruiting office as a student, sending out letters to recruits. So, diehard Michigan State fan. And I grew up watching these games, but was nowhere near the talent level to get recruited. And I got called to the office like they do for, you know, D3 coaches come in. And I walked down and I saw Michigan State's helmet on Coach Treadwell's shirt. And I was like, what's going on? My first thought is like, oh, there must be some D3 school that has the same logo as Michigan State that I don't know about.
Right.
And then, you know, we start talking and, you know, they have a couple walk-on spots available. And fast forward, like, Coach D'Antonio calls me and basically gives me the opportunity to come walk on. And my mind was just blown. Like, my head was spinning. But in the same breath, I was so nervous because, like, I mean, there was such a gap between me and a starting Division I football player, especially Michigan State, that I questioned what I should do. So I literally made a pros and cons list with my mom, and we still have it. My mom and my dad, we sat in the living room, pros and cons, you know, of going to the Division III school, Michigan State. And there was a lot of pros to Adrian College, which was the school. And I'll never forget the last thing at Michigan State was like, will you regret this? And knowing that I would probably regret it the rest of my life, I didn't just try, like, that was a deciding factor. And I pretty much carried that my entire life. Like, I always ask myself, any decision, I'm like, am I going to regret? Am I going to be second guessing this? And if the answer is yes, I tend to take a chance. So it served me well. I ended up, the fourth day of camp, I wanted to quit. I mean, I'll never forget. I got out of the car. You know, I'm an only child. My parents and I, we still talk about, like, when we drove up to Michigan State to drop me off, the car was dead silent. Like, I think we were all
just nervous.
Very nervous. And I get out of the car and I saw Pete Clifford, who was like our starting left tackle. He was like 6'7", 330, hair down to his shoulders, and just like the baddest looking dude of all time. And I remember thinking, like, I don't even know what I got myself into. But I'm happy to be here. And my goal was like, if I can just be on the team, maybe I get on some special teams my senior year, like, that's a win. That's still a dream come true.
Right.
But from that point, you know, the first semester was hell. I mean, I was struggling. I was a math major. I'm taking, you know, all these calculus classes. You know, school was just like hitting me right in the face. Morning lifts, not sleeping well. You know, cultural adaptation. I mean, I'm from this small country town. There's people from all over the United States here and just making friends. I mean, everything you could imagine was being thrown at me. And I had a tough go the first semester. And I wanted to quit probably every single day. But like I said, like when you're in that situation, you're around people that like exceed your capabilities at the time, like it pulls the best out of you. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of that first semester, you know, I kind of turned to the weight room and started lifting with my roommate, like after practice and going to the IM building and doing extra stuff. And by the end of that first semester, I was like, I think I can play here, you know, and then moving to spring ball, all of a sudden I'm getting reps with like second string and, you know, my entire mindset shifted.
What's that process look like when you get invited to walk on?
Yeah.
How much, like you say you show up, how much time does the team, do the coaches give you to say, like, you either stay on the team and you get a chance, yeah, or you're cut, you're not making it?
Yeah, I mean, so I was what's called a preferred walk-on, which means basically, like, you're going to come, you're going to have a place on the team in the fall. You're not going to have a scholarship, but you're going to get invited to camp, right? So it's basically like, so I was pretty certain that I was going to make it through camp and be there for the fall semester. That was pretty much it. And honestly, they could have cut me at any time. So I constantly had a feeling of like, you know, I just got to hang on here. And there were some days where I literally thought that I might just get cut. Like they might come up to me and be like, I'd be scared to walk by Coach D'Antonio in the hall. One, because he was a super intimidating guy. Two, you know, I really felt like I didn't belong. And it wasn't like this imposter syndrome like I'm talking about. Like I literally did not belong. Like I was not good enough to be there at the time. But I also had a pretty high ceiling and was able to adapt like relatively quickly. So I showed up and, you know, I knew I had a spot in the semester, but it felt like, you know, I was just trying to earn my stay like day by day, which isn't very like, not a very settling feeling.
No, I can imagine.
Yeah.
You feel like you're on the chopping block at all times.
All times.
You're waiting to look over your shoulder and someone is there to deliver the bad news.
Yeah, that was it. I mean, that's how every day pretty much felt.
But you ended up starting.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I ended up, like I said, I put a ton of time in and I got to a place where like I was like, so that next year, I actually like Coach D'Antonio came up to me before camp and was like, we're going to give you a chance like to earn a starting spot. So I made a huge jump that first year and ended up tearing my quad, which is pretty gnarly. If anyone's seen it, it's pretty bad. And so I'm out that season. Next season, I have to have knee surgery. I'll never forget, you know, I'm rotating in with the twos, you know, getting some starting reps and I make a cut, you know, a week out from our first game and I feel like this sharp pain in my knee and I broke off some cartilage on the head of my femur and I had surgery and I remember it. I had surgery right before our first game, which, you know, still hadn't played a down yet. I had surgery. Went to warmups, but I couldn't stay at the game because they didn't want me to get hit on the sidelines. And I remember like crutching away from the stadium at the first game, hearing the crowd in the background just by myself. Like, so it's a ghost town outside of a stadium during a game. And like, that was a low. That was a big time low. I mean, luckily my parents were there and, you know, I have an amazing support system, but it was almost like you could hear your dreams happening without being there. And it was tough.
And they're like, the further you get away from it and the noise and
just kind
the,
of
the sounds, like you hear it fading, it's almost like your dreams are fading as well.
And that's how it felt. You know, after 3 years of not playing it down, it felt like is this ever going to happen? You know, almost felt like it was destined not to happen. And so that offseason, I came back. I tried to rehab my knee, but it just felt horrible. I couldn't extend it. Sharp pain the entire time. And I remember walking to a lift right before spring ball, going into my fourth year now, having not played. I was talking to Kirk Cousins. He was walking with me and I was like, Kirk, I think I have to hang it up. Like, I can't run. Like, I can't, you know, I'm like 75%. I don't know what else to do. The doctors like didn't have any good answers. Like, I'm wearing a knee brace that like, you know, pushes your knee lateral from the inside to try to alleviate the pressure on the certain part of my knee that's hurt, and it just wasn't going well. So I was like talking to Kirk and I was like, I'm going to give spring ball a shot and see what happens. And, but if not, you know, this might be the end. And I was actually coming to peace with that, trying to, I mean, relative. And first spring practice, I'll never forget, we had a huge left tackle. His name was Henry Conway. I came off the edge. I was playing at the end of the time and I hit him pretty square, like my shoulder, and my leg was locked out and it just went like pop, like massive crack. And I was like, here we go. Here we go. This is going to be the fourth year and I'm not going to play. But didn't feel horrible afterwards. Woke up the next day and we went to warm up and practice. All my pain was gone. Like it was brand new. And they think like whatever, you know, that chunk of bone that broke off earlier, they think that like got dislodged somewhere or moved around and, you know, ended up in a place that didn't cause any more pain. And that was just floating around causing issues. And then I was 100%. So I ended up playing that fall and then really came into my own when I got moved to fullback. I mean, I was almost a different person from playing defensive end to fullback, because when I got moved to fullback, I felt like I was the tip of the arrow for our team. Like it was up to me to set the tone, and I would sacrifice anything like to take that person's soul. Like across from me, like the mentality and the mindset and the place I would get to for games was dark. And I played angry, and not everybody has to do that, but you know, it was very effective for me. And I just felt like I came into my own and I thrived in that position just because, you know, I felt like such a selfless responsibility to literally set the tone for the entire game in that position.
What would you do? Like, what would the process look like in terms of putting yourself there mentally?
Well, I mean, I would listen to Psychosocial by Slipknot on the way to every single game. And I would convince myself that, you know, the guys across the ball from me, you know, the guys on the other sideline were basically attacking my brothers, like my family. And I would get to such, you know, I would just create these stories in my head and just, you know, basically pit them as my mortal enemy. And by the time the game started, I would tell myself these stories and, you know, I literally wanted to take their soul. Like it wasn't like a, you know, oh, I want to hit them hard and play hard, but I want to be okay. Like I wouldn't do literally anything. And I would sacrifice my body. I would throw it in there. I think about, you know, it just felt invincible. And I got myself to a place where I was stronger than everyone else. I was bigger than everybody else. So there were very few times where I feel like I couldn't do that. And, you know, I would beg for the first play of the game to be like an ISO so I could just blow up the middle linebacker and set the tone for the rest of the game.
So do you think that from the time you walked on to that fourth year when you started, there was obviously a transformation and evolution in your body? You got stronger, you were hitting the weights more, you got more fit. But there's also this evolution and transformation of the mind as well to get to that place.
Yeah, I think that they went hand in hand. I think even my whole life, you know, the reason I even had the confidence to try to go to Michigan State was the fact that I had gotten myself more physically fit and stronger. And I felt like I could at least line up like and look like I belonged. You know, I grew up, I was like an overweight kid. I wasn't in good shape. So like I connect my confidence so much with like my fitness and how I feel and my strength. And so like, that's what I leaned on. And then throughout the process of college, I gained so much confidence through that. By the time my senior year came around, I was the strongest guy on the team. You know, I was throwing up weights that I never even dreamed of. And I think because I knew that, even though that doesn't have a direct correlation with football all the time, like knowing that in my head just made me be able to attack and just play in a way that I never could have before.
This is something that I reference a lot, but you have to stack these wins in life, and as you stack more wins, which also come with losses along the way, those wins build confidence.
Definitely.
And that confidence you build through these small wins that just accumulate, I mean, that confidence can become so strong that you get to a point where you're like, there's literally nothing I can't do. Like, if I want to do it, I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah.
And I've gone through that transformation as well, because when I was younger, I had no confidence in myself. Where I set the bar of where I could get one day was so low that I knew it was achievable, but I was afraid to set the bar too high because I feared failure. And I had 100% imposter syndrome early on. But as soon as I started trying more things and then stacking some of these wins, it built more confidence. You finally get to a point where you're like, if it's something I want to do, I'm going to make it happen. It might take years and years and years to get there, but I'm going to make it happen. And that's such a powerful place to be.
100%. Like, I've had the exact same evolution. I mean, I was constantly doubting myself. And now I feel like you said, like, I don't think it matters, like, what bucket the win is in. It could be, like, physical or business or emotional. Like, I think the wins, regardless, they all breed confidence. Like, it doesn't, like, because you're starting a business, I don't think it means, it needs to be in the business world to kind of give you confidence in that bucket. I think it's all cumulative. And I think, like, one of my favorite quotes is, like, it doesn't take you 10 years to learn how to start a business. It takes you 10 years to become the person you need to be to start the business.
100%.
And that's so true. Like, it's nothing to do with knowledge and everything to do with, like, stacking those wins and building that confidence, becoming the type of person that can lead a brand or an idea or a company.
Yeah. I mean, our situations are kind of opposite, where, like, fitness and sports for you built the confidence to then apply that mindset to building a business.
Yeah.
With Dream Recovery,
right,
for example. My confidence was built through building a business, which I then applied to, you know, competitions and races and my fitness. So, yeah, like you said, one thing doesn't have to directly apply to that one area of focus of your life, but right, confidence in general can be applied to everything you're doing.
Yeah.
And everything that you try to do, it's like the magic touch to it.
Right. Yeah. What was, like, your biggest insecurity growing up?
I mean, when I was younger, I had an eating disorder.
Okay.
And I had a lot of insecurity around that. More so of, like, people knowing and finding out that I had this eating disorder, because for me, it felt like a weakness. I didn't want people to judge me or evaluate me based off of this weakness that I thought and knew that I had. So that was an insecurity. But I'd say, like, my biggest insecurity was, you know, from growing up in a small town as well. And I would see these people in the world doing these amazing things, building businesses, bringing innovation to technology, the world, politics, all these things. I knew that there were people out there doing that, but for me, Nick Baer in Palmyra, Pennsylvania, they could have been aliens.
Yeah.
For all I knew, because there was such this separation in terms of what they're doing and what I thought I could do. So my dream, my plan when I was growing up was that I was going to go to college, I was going to serve in the army, and then I was going to be a chicken farmer for the rest of my life. So my brother and I and my grandfather, we were looking at land in central Pennsylvania. We were talking to, like, Bell and Evans to work through chicken contracts.
That's wild.
And we're going to get chicken houses. We're going to get land, build chicken houses, and we were going to, you know, do broiler chickens for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
Because that's what I knew. That's what was comfortable. And I was afraid to step out into what was uncomfortable and the unknown, because the ceiling in which I put in place was just, it was low. And when I finally realized, and my time in the military actually gave me a lot of confidence. I learned a lot there, and I learned a lot and gained a lot of confidence in building a business.
Do you remember a distinct moment where you felt like that? Like, do you remember the moment when you decided, like, that wasn't your path? Or was there something that, like, changed, like, drastically altered that?
It was probably when I was in Korea in 2016, because up until that point, the business was growing slowly. But in 2016, I knew I had about a year left in the army. I was about to transition back from South Korea to the States, beginning my transition out of the military back into civilian life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very aware that the money I was making with BPN could not support me moving forward. So I had to put something in place or do something to make money outside of being in the military and building BPN.
Mm-hmm.
So by default, I was like, okay, well, when I get back from Korea and I start transitioning out of the military, I'll go pursue this chicken farming operation. I'll keep building BPN on the side and just see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
That was as far as my plan went. But then when I got to Korea and I dedicated all my time into building the business, I went all in and it finally started to grow. I didn't need that plan B of chicken farming any longer, because I knew that I saw the opportunity. I saw what it could be, because
mm-hmm.
I finally got some more wins and I needed that win to give me the confidence to keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, like, I was just thinking about, cause how ours a little bit the opposite. Like it's, I mean, the business side seems like you grew up, like that was like an insecurity of like you said, they're aliens. So you didn't really know even how to pursue that. And I think mine might've been the opposite one, just cause the flow of me playing football, but two, like my insecurity was so focused on my perception myself and being overweight and not feeling good about like the image I was portraying, that until I figured that out, I don't think I could have done anything. And as my fitness and as my my image and confidence in myself, not just physically, but just, you know, what's important in my value has grown, I feel like everything else has just accelerated. So I feel like you almost have to attack like that main thing, that main insecurity, before anything can happen on a big scale.
I completely agree.
Like I could have, like if I didn't feel good about myself and my health and my wellness, like I could not be doing what I'm doing now. And it has nothing to do with knowledge and everything to do with confidence.
Yeah. I mean, confidence is, it's easier said than done. You know, I'm sure there's people like listening to this right now thinking, yeah, you guys can talk about confidence because you're on the other side of it right now. But one of the questions I wish I would have been able to ask myself when I was younger, or I would encourage people to ask themselves, if there's something that you're curious about doing, but you're so afraid of the outcome, you're so afraid of the perceptions of other people, ask yourself the question, what's the worst that's going to happen?
Definitely.
I fail and everyone laughs at me. Okay, well, it puts me in the same exact spot I'm in right now.
Which, when you're a kid, is pretty bad sometimes. Like, that is a big fear, but when you really break it down, I don't think people really do. I mean, what's the worst that can happen is one of the best internal processes to work through that anybody can do. Jen Cohen, who's a good friend, like that's one of her big things in her book. But you know, when you actually break it down, like you're pretty bulletproof when it comes down to how taking a risk can affect you. Most of it is literally just perception and how people feel or what people say about you. But regardless, like they probably aren't saying anything about you right now until you take a chance. So, you know, you're learning and you're getting your name out there and you're gonna push that envelope of what you think you're capable of.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I probably didn't ask myself that till I was 25 years old. Well, maybe when I went to Michigan State, honestly, that's probably the first time I was like, what is the worst that can happen? I transferred to Adrian College. And at that point, I realized that, like, you know, I should do it. And on the fourth day, my mom was calling Adrian College trying to get my transcript together. So I was ready to fall back on that. But
you need to stack those wins.
Yeah.
But you'll never be able to stack the wins if you don't try, if you don't put yourself out there, because no one's selling wins.
No.
You can't buy wins. You have to go earn them.
Definitely.
And it's tough and it's painful, but like when you stack enough of them and you earn enough of them, you look at the most successful people in the world. People try to figure out how they got there. What's the blueprint? What's the magic sauce? Like, where's the magic pill? They just stacked wins along the way. And they've taken so many hits and so many losses.
Well, yeah, I think they just go. They just do.
You have to.
And like, it's almost like getting at bats in baseball. It's like, if you just go after all these different ideas and try things, like you said, like you're going to lose, but it's not about the percentage of wins you get. It's about the total number of wins, right? So like the more you do, the more wins you get, regardless of how many losses you have. And those build insane amounts of confidence. You can't cheat it either. Like there's no way to like, have these two really good wins and then all of a sudden have this massive amount of confidence. Like it's a process and there's no way to speed that up besides just doing more stuff.
I was actually listening to an audio book a few weeks ago. I can't remember which book it was. I'm often listening to a few books at one time. I'll bounce back and forth. But they use the analogy of baseball players and batting averages. And if someone's batting 300,
they're in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, they're great. That's 3 out of 10.
Yeah.
If you gave me those chances in anything else, I'd say, that's shit.
No way.
That sucks. But 3 out of 10 is a Hall of Fame player.
Mm-hmm.
So apply that to other things you do. Like, you have to be willing to lose. You have to be willing to risk things, part of things along the process. And if you get some wins, you're still moving forward.
100%. And even if you don't, it's like, it's so cliche. Like, you learn from like your losses and your failures. But yeah, I'm a pretty analytical, like, you know, like I said, I was like a math major when I first got to college. And it's like, you learn so much from just experience in general. Like, so you really, as long, you know, a loss is a pretty relative term. You know what I mean? Obviously, if a business folds or you don't accomplish a certain feat, that's one thing. But just the data and information you usually pull from that stuff can be considered a win if you just reshape how you look at it.
Mm-hmm. So obviously throughout college, you adapted.
Yeah.
You adapted to a lot of different obstacles and situations, especially with a lot of your injuries.
Yeah.
And in preparation for this conversation today, I was on a run this morning, first run back since CIM. And right now the book I'm listening to is Hidden Potential by Adam Grant. And I knew I wanted to tie this quote that I heard today in the book into some part of this conversation today. And I think this is pretty applicable, talking about being adaptable. And he talks about in this book how the species in the world that continue to exist aren't always the smartest or the strongest, but the ones who are able to adapt. And I think it's something that everyone can take away. It's something I you know, when I'm reading or listening to a book, if there's something that hits me, I stop that run and I have to write it down in my notes. Because as we often try to be the smartest, or we think that the people who are the smartest and the strongest are the ones who are going to outlive, out-endure everyone and everything else. It is always the people who are adaptable. And if you can find out how to be adaptable, like you did in college, to a point where year four you're starting and you go spend some time in the NFL, if you learn how to be adaptable, you have such a huge chance of success in the longevity of life.
100%. If I could say, I think if you could take one attribute of literally anything out there of you know, ambition and, you know, being motivated or, you know, discipline, literally any keyword you could find, I think adaptability is the most powerful thing there is. And Mark Cuban always says that, you know, just being able to adapt to a situation. But I think on the flip side, the awareness to know that you are adaptable in almost any situation you're going to be in is also something you have to protect, because when you start seeing yourself in situations that if you do start to adapt, you need to get out of it. You know, you start hanging around the wrong crowds, not being in the right place, not being around the type of things that, you know, replicate your values, you also start to adapt to that. And I've been in situations where, you know, I've been around people or been doing things that, you know, I took a step back and I realized I am adapting to the situation, and that's not the way that I want to be adapting. And adapting is extremely powerful, both positive and negative.
Yeah, I think you want to be adaptable in the sense of being resilient, but not being adaptable in the way of being a chameleon.
Right, exactly. And that's a hard line, you know, but I think it comes back to values. Like, you know, if you're extremely comfortable with what you believe in and what's important to you, usually you are adaptable. But I think when you're trying to please people, it's very easy to become a chameleon.
100%. So I want to kind of pivot the conversation a little bit after giving some context.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about sleep, because obviously you are the founder of a sleep-based company.
Yeah.
Sleep expert. And something that's interesting that I've found over these last couple of years of having conversations with people and doing podcasts is I'll talk to athletes, collegiate or professional, and you probably have some good context into this as well because you're married to an Olympian.
Yeah.
But I've talked to some of these athletes before. I'm like, you must be dialed in with everything you do, from sleep, nutrition, to training. And I ask them about their diet, what they eat before the game, what they eat after. And they're like, McDonald's?
Yeah.
And some of these people are just God-given talent in their DNA individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have to optimize everything.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you've seen two different spectrums in terms of athletes. When did sleep become an interest to you, a way to biohack, to optimize? I mean, mm-hmm. sleep is essentially a performance enhancing drug in its own way. Was there a moment where you were like, holy crap, I'm missing this huge ability to transform?
No, I think it was more of a gradual realization. But it did stem in college for sure. You know, I used to read Muscle and Fitness and all those magazines. And because I felt so out of place, I did become obsessed with human performance. So I was pretty much trying to find an edge wherever it was.
You have to.
Yeah. And so I was like nerding out, reading, you know, research articles in college and skimming through all the stuff about hormone levels and testosterone and, you know, creatine was like kind of new at the time. So, sleep kept popping up more and more, but there wasn't a lot of clinical data on sleep back then.
Especially, what year was this?
This was like 2008, you know? So there wasn't a lot of data in regards to performance. There was like health and wellness, longevity stuff, but it's relatively new, you know, the bulk of the studies being done. So I remember distinctly is 2008 reading a study on the effects of loss of sleep and testosterone levels and then growth hormone levels. And then, you know, connecting that to performance and in, you know, my performance on the field. And we started to take sleep more seriously. Like, you know, I would at least think about that. Now, most college kids, like, yes, we went out, we had a good time. I didn't sleep the best, but I was very aware, like, if we had a big workout the next day, we weren't going to do any of that stuff. And we were pretty dialed in. And then after football, started working with athletes on the performance side and then transitioned into, you know, I started working at Equinox and got on the corporate side and stuff. And I got to spend a lot of time with Dr. Jennifer Martin, who was at UCLA. It really opened my eyes to the psychology of sleep and then also just the impactfulness across all buckets of life. And shortly after I started, you know, focusing more and more on sleep because I was so intrigued and learning and taking courses and all this stuff and eventually started speaking on it. And when I really like, you know, dug my heels in and really tried to learn everything I could was when I would hear the responses from people about the impacts on their life. I mean, like if you want to change someone's life, whatever they're trying to do, and you can optimize their sleep, one, it's going to make them, it's almost going to like grease the skids as far as achieving any goals. And two, like they're just going to feel so much better. So it was so fulfilling to help people out in a way that wasn't often thought about back then. You know, people didn't really start taking sleep seriously, I'd say, till 5 years ago. And so I was, you know, pretty early on. Like I would do like corporate presentations at companies in New York and they'd be like, how long do you need? Like 10 minutes. And I was like, no, it's like 45 minutes to an hour. And they're like, you can talk about sleep for 45 minutes. And it was still like such a, you know, out of box kind of thought process. And so it's been cool to see just the evolution of society and how people are taking it seriously.
You can tell people are respecting sleep a lot more now. Because it used to be viewed as a distraction. You would hear people say, like, I'll sleep when I'm dead. And like, work is more important than sleep. And I mean, I'll be honest, in the last decade plus of building a business and training for all these events and now being a father and a husband, I don't get nearly as much sleep as I want and need.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of that. I know that if I would sleep more, I would feel better.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to move things around in my schedule to allow for that, especially now that this marathon's over. But I think people are now respecting sleep much more than they used to.
Yeah, I think they're starting to wrap their head around the idea that it's not about feeling tired. You know, it's not just being sleepy and being low energy. It's really about like cognitive function and how efficient you can be in certain tasks and decision-making and emotional intelligence. Like it's things that are subconscious, right? Like the things that are really impacted by sleep are like things like your reaction time, your ability to read people's faces, even like your facial expressions and matching your emotion. Like that stuff you can't like out tough, or you can't push through, or, mm-hmm. you know, try to act like it's not affecting you. That's stuff that you have zero control over. And I think that like sleep is a tool in a way that's unlike any other, where it's really just making you better and more efficient. And like you said, optimizing these different portions of your life. It's not about feeling tired and having energy. It's about literally like becoming like the most streamlined, efficient version of yourself. And I think that's how people have to look at it, not taking time away, but really it's almost like making the time you're actually working and doing stuff, you know, twice as effective. So you don't need as much time, because you're going to be in such a clear, focused mindset, and you're able to have perspective. And I think, you know, when you're underslept, like many of the decisions you're making are actually going to cause things to need more time to be sorted out, because it's not like you're not able to have the vision that you would when you're optimized.
It's like, whenever I go into any of these big endurance preps, my hormones always take a hit.
Yeah.
Some of that's from just accumulation of training, being overtrained, trying to get leaner, so my diet changes.
Yeah. But you do blood work after every event.
Yeah, I always get blood work done. But what happens in a prep is the amount of time that I'm training increases.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm also trying to fit in my normal work schedule and family life. So where I typically pull from to make time for everything else is for my sleep.
Right.
And I know that has a direct correlation to impacts on hormones.
Yeah.
What have you seen from both men and women, the impact on hormones, primarily in men, testosterone, with poor quality or lack of sleep?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, poor sleep, especially a big shift. It's like if you go from sleeping a normal amount or an optimal amount to a whole month of, like, especially if someone has a kid or something like that, and you go to sleeping like 5 hours a night, you know, within a month you can see significant drops in testosterone. Like I've seen wild decreases. Like, you know, I've seen people have a third of the testosterone they did after like a 1 month span of sleeping pretty poorly. And sometimes, you know, alcohol can be involved or whatever, but in general, you know, majority of your testosterone is produced during that first sleep cycle. And then also that first sleep cycle, like, is the biggest growth hormone spike of the entire day, right? So you're talking about like your two primary performance enhancing hormones that are dependent on that first sleep cycle to be produced. And a lot of times what happens is if you're not sleeping efficiently, or you do something where you're missing out on that cycle, you just kind of miss out on that production, it seems. It seems like it's kind of like if you don't use it, you lose it mentality or mm-hmm. type of situation. And so you almost miss out on that production. And then cumulatively, your body really can't make up for it. But even one night of sleep is going to impact those things. It's just your body's able to recover if you get back on the routine.
But right.
It's pretty wild. And I think I think the mindset shift, like you were talking about scheduling, I think everyone buckets like sleep in the recovery category. But if you look at every study like I'm talking about, or anybody's talking about, they're all what happens after a poor night's sleep, right? Which has nothing to do with the recovery. It's really more of like a prep. So, you know, I think of the night's sleep as the foundation for performance the next day, right? So how can you build the strongest foundation in that pyramid to perform at the highest level? And I think when people think about scheduling it, you have to start there and then work backwards, as opposed to, like you're saying, oh, here's everything I have to do in the day. Oh, I need a couple more hours here or there. Let's cut into my sleep, because I promise whatever you're doing isn't going to be at the level that you want it to be.
Right. So I always talk about backwards planning.
Yeah.
So it's almost like before I apply backwards planning to any day, project, operation, I have to carve out. I can't give myself 24 hours. I have to carve out the hours of sleep first.
Right.
So say I want to sleep 8 hours. That then gives me 16 hours to backwards plan the remainder of my day. But I'm pre-carving out those sleep hours because they are the priority to build the foundation for everything else.
Yeah, and I think that really the difference, I think everybody has probably known that for 10 years, but no one's had the buy-in to truly believe that sleep's going to have that big of an impact. It's more about the belief at your core.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think a lot of people are still there. Like, I don't think people truly believe that they'll get more done and be as efficient if they focus on sleep. I still think when push comes to shove and there's a meeting or a task, they're probably going to cover it out of their sleep. But I think the more and more data, we're starting to see people realizing, like, this is no joke, and it needs to be a priority for a million different reasons. And it, and once you kind of experience that, I think there's no going back. I've gotten to a place where it takes a lot for me to schedule a red eye or a flight that's really going to mess up my sleep. And my wife gets mad at me sometimes because I'm kind of particular about it. But, I also, like we were saying, like, I just love feeling really good. Like, when you feel great, like, life can throw a lot of things at you and it just kind of brush it off. But like, when you're not feeling good, things just seem amplified. Issues seem harder. Arguments get more intense. Problems seem bigger than they are. So I'm kind of obsessed with just constantly feeling good. And, I've made that shift and it's become such a priority that I don't think I could go back, because I've realized that it's added such value to my life. And I feel like, especially from a mental health perspective, like, people don't realize almost every clinical psychiatric disorder has a sleep issue as a symptom. So when it comes to just, being stable in your mood and your day to day, and, being the best, like, father or friend or, teammate, like, you're almost doing a disservice by not committing that, because you're not going to be the same person, or you're not going to be the person that you want to be if you're chronically underslept.
So it's not selfish. It's actually selfless.
100%. I've literally had this argument with people. It's like, I do think sleep is the most selfless thing you can do. If you can look at it through the lens of, I'm going to pour myself into other people. I'm going to pour myself into my relationship, my marriage, fatherhood, my teammates. And if that's what you're truly doing, then sleep is the most selfless thing you can do, because you are going to be the best version of yourself. And if you're not sleeping well, you're committing to being like 75% of a father, of a teammate, all these different things. So if you're doing the right things and you care about people, I think sleep is the most selfless thing you can do.
I'd love to talk about how to optimize sleep and kind of put them into two categories. Category one is something that everyone can do without buying something, like routine, turning the temperature down in your house, stuff like that. And then the second category being like something you can add on top of, like the mouth tape and mask. So could you kind of share some tips for people of category one, you can do this right now.
Yep.
Category two, icing on the cake.
Yeah. So I think like the three lowest hanging fruit, like the three easiest things to do that people might not do is, one, create a continuum from the evening to your bedroom, meaning from a psychological perspective and a lighting perspective, transitioning your lighting and your screen usage just like the sun would, and gradually tapering off the night. A lot of people have screens and loud noises and they're watching TV and all the lights are on in their place. And then all of a sudden they have this like, boom, go in my bedroom and expect to fall asleep right away. Right. So that's a really easy thing to do. And I think psychologically it has a really big impact. The other thing is a ton of people are using melatonin nowadays, and melatonin is triggered. The production is triggered by darkness. So no wonder people are using it so often, because usually they're in front of bright lights, all the way up until the time they actually go to bed.
Right.
So that's easy. I think temperature is really easy. Having a cool, dark room is pretty straightforward and easy. And temperature regulation plays a massive impact on getting into deep sleep cycles. So that's an easy change. Just put the thermostat down, open a window, whatever it may be. But people don't often think about that. And I think one of the things that's most impactful that people really rarely think about is front-loading hydration. Even people that have a hard time sleeping, a lot of times they wake up in the middle of the night and they can't stop thinking about something, or they're stressing out about something, and that's something to address. But, I like to think about it as like playing the odds, So when you wake up in the middle of the night, there's a chance like you could get attached to a thought or start worrying about something in your life, and you want to give your brain the least amount of opportunities to do that, right? Because every time you wake up, there's a chance that could happen, or you might not be able to fall asleep. There's a chance you might stub your toe on the way to the toilet and not be able to fall back asleep for that. You know what I mean? So you want to minimize those chances, and hydration is usually something people don't really think about, but they'll have a ton of fluid intake up until they go to bed and probably have to get up 3, 4, 5 times throughout the night. And that could be 1 or 2 times. So we always recommend front loading the hydration the first 12 hours of the day and then tapering it off as the night goes on. And then the other thing is not drinking more than like 2 or 3 ounces at a time in the evening. Because if you drink more than like 5 ounces, it'll trigger you to urinate more often and you'll have to get up more often to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. So people, you know, I'll talk to people all the time, they get up 5 times in the middle of the night to go pee because they want to be hydrated and they'll crush 24 ounces of water right before they go to bed when that's probably the worst thing you can be doing.
Yeah, I wake up once in the middle of the night every night to go to the bathroom.
That's great. That's pretty normal.
Just one time. But then when I wake up and my alarm clock goes off, it's like, I got to go
again. Yeah, yeah.
So I do a pretty good job with hydration. We have, right now we have the Sleep 8 pad over our mattress that allows it to bring our bed temperature down.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, we had the Chili sleep pad.
Yep.
That's been game changing for me because I used to always wake up in the middle of the night in the morning dripping in sweat.
Hot, yeah.
The mattress would be soaked.
Mm-hmm.
So adding that, like, I think it's a great investment.
Definitely.
Some way bringing the temperature of your bed down and the room. I mean, for me, our room's like a wind tunnel at night. We have like 2 fans. We got our Chili sleep pad going on. Humidifier.
Does Steph have the same temperature request as you, or do you guys have different?
Hers is a little warmer.
Yeah, that tends to be the case.
Guys, hers is a little warmer than mine. Yeah,
guys sleep a little cooler, it seems like.
I would even prefer, like, I like sleeping in a sweatshirt and dropping the temperature even more.
I like that too.
That's super comfortable for me.
Yeah. I haven't used some of those, the chillers. I have a Bright Balance bed. It's like a AI, it can put like vibrations through the bed and like match like meditations and sounds. It's pretty cool. But yeah, we have the room freezing usually, and that's a battle. But I'm probably going to try one out because it's getting to the point where KD wants it warmer. So trying to figure out like a, you know, compromise there.
It's game changing.
Yeah.
Game changing. What about routine? Like, how important is routine in trying to, like, say you can't get 8 hours a night or 9 hours a night or whatever, is maintaining a routine still equally as important?
Yeah, I mean, I should have went back, and far outweighing anything I said previously, staying within 30 minutes of your wake-up time and bedtime is the most impactful thing you can do for your sleep. I mean, it's hands down. Like, the more and more that comes out, like, I don't even think we realize yet how important that is and how much of an impact it has when you deviate outside of that 30-minute mark. Whoop is doing a lot of cool stuff with that right now. But basically, like, outside the 30-minute mark, every 5 minutes, you can predictably estimate someone's impact, or the impact that the lack of sleep has on their HRV, resting heart, like all these like performance biometrics. So like, again, it's not just about being able to fall asleep and wake up and not feeling tired. Like, your body is under physiological stress when you're deviating out of your normal circadian rhythm. I think a lot of people mess that up, you know, on the weekends, like you stay up a little later, and it's hard because there's a balance. Like, you have to be a normal human being, but a lot of people just, you know, give themselves social jet lag on the weekend by staying up super late and then sleeping in. And then it takes them, you know, Monday, Tuesday, sometimes Wednesday, to recover from that shift in circadian rhythm. It probably has nothing to do with like drinking or staying out, and everything to do with their sleep. And they don't really understand why that's happening.
I always feel extra tired on Sundays. Saturday nights are the nights when I sleep in the longest. I get the most sleep.
Right.
So am I feeling this fatigue, this jet lagged feeling because of the extra sleep and being out of my routine?
It's more about the inconsistency in your bedtime and wake time.
Interesting.
So I'm guessing Saturday nights, that's probably like when you're going out date night, or like maybe you're having a drink, or maybe you're staying up a couple hours later.
Yeah.
It's more from that shift in time than like the amount of sleep. Like, if I would venture to say, if you went to bed at the same time and then slept in past the normal wake time, you'd probably feel fine. It's just, you probably just shifted over, and then that's impacted. And then the hard part is if that next night is impacted because you slept in later, now you're talking about like a cascading effect where that's how it starts to affect multiple days.
Right.
And kind of linger.
Yeah. Right now I'm feeling the effects of being in Sacramento, California this past weekend. One, my whole sleep schedule is messed up because
West to East is the worst.
Oh my gosh,
it's brutal.
I'm waking up at like 3:30 a.m. every day right now because we're 2 hours ahead.
Mm-hmm. How long were you out there?
Two nights.
Oh, you just
two nights.
Yeah.
And we got out there the morning of the race. I had to be up at 3 because we had to get shuttled out to the starting line. Went and ran a marathon, and we traveled all day. So we didn't get back into Nashville until 10:30 p.m. that night. Didn't get to sleep until 12.
Brutal.
That night,
I can't fall asleep. After also, when I land, and like, I can't fall asleep.
I had a
horrible
night of sleep.
That happened to me. I got stranded in Charlotte, and I got stranded, and I slept so bad. I got home at like 1 in the morning.
Yeah, so I'm feeling that. And then as soon as we got back, Charlie was sick. So I was sleeping on the floor in her bedroom because she didn't want to sleep in her crib. She wanted to sleep on the floor. So I slept a few hours that night. So all those things are compounding, and I'm feeling it so much this week. And I keep asking myself, like, why am I so tired this week?
Yeah.
Why am I so fatigued?
Now you're getting IVs. Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's no overcoming that. Like, that's the thing. There's certain things you can do to like hack other things, you know, nutrition issues or, you know, workout stuff. But like, there's no way to hack being underslept. Like it is what it is. And the best thing you can actually do, like if you have a night where you sleep horrible, really the best thing you can do is nothing. Just power through it and get back on your regular rhythm, because a lot of people will overconsume caffeine, or they'll take a nap and they're not used to taking naps, and then they can't fall asleep that night. And then you're talking about multiple day impacts, where if you just power through, kind of bite the bullet and you know, get through that day, you'll probably fall right back into your normal rhythm, and it'll be a one day thing, where most people, you know, probably cause a two or three day issue because they try to throw these little tools at it, and it ends up being a long term negative.
So that's a category one. Those are things that people can start doing right now, mm-hmm. which is pretty easy for most people to implement. Obviously, there's things that happen in life. Kids get sick, get back from late from a flight, marathon, project you're working on that you have to knock out. It keeps you up till 2 a.m. Things happen. You're going to get thrown off course. But if you can maintain that routine and those foundational pieces of sleep, mm-hmm. it's going to make a massive impact.
Definitely.
What can you layer on top of that? Which, you know, I'm sure talking about mouth tape, which is so interesting.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk about mouth tape, actually, because they probably blow most people's minds away.
Yeah.
So like, what are these things we can layer on top?
I mean, there's a lot of stuff, you know, there are a ton of things you can do. And some of it is different for every person, you know, everywhere from white noise to obviously like the mouth tape, sleep masks, you know, blackout curtains, blue light blocking glasses. Like there's a ton of stuff out there.
Are you a white noise person?
I'm not. White noise is interesting. You know, white noise is one of those things where like, if you have nothing and you sleep fine and there's not any noise, if you add it, it's not going to make your sleep better. But if there's noises and stuff that distribute throughout the night, it can be useful to drown those out. Mm-hmm. So for athletes, sometimes we'll recommend getting a machine, because on the road, sometimes, you know, hotels, you might be next to the elevator, you know, it's loud, people are opening doors, whatever it may be. You don't know the situation. It can be useful to drown that stuff out, but you have to get used to it first. So that can be a good tool for an athlete specifically, especially when you're livelihood is dependent on your performance. Like that's when you almost got to take in every measure. But
I'm not a white noise person. Never was. I can sleep fine with it. But Steph is. Steph needs white noise. So if we're traveling and she forgets her white noise machine, and she'll download an app and use something there. But I can sleep in complete silence. I can sleep through things. I'm sure being in the military helped me with that.
Definitely.
But Steph is someone who needs white noise.
Well, I mean, she probably realizes a ton on the road. Like if you're on the road, is she like very particular about that?
Extremely.
So like the first night you're in a new environment, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense. Like you're on high alert. And so the first night you're in any hotel room or new environment, your brain is almost twice as sensitive to sound as normal. So that's when it's super important. And we'll also have athletes travel with earplugs for that reason. So taking care of sound and, you know, making sure like if that's your routine, you have that first night of travel is by far the most impacted by, you know, different noises in the room.
That's how she is.
Yeah. And then you kind of settle in once you get used to it. It makes sense. You know, like as we're evolving, you know, you're somewhere new, you don't know the environment. It makes sense that we were like on high alert and then you kind of ease in.
Right. Other than that, white noise, what's number two go-to for some of these athletes you work with?
I mean, I think the sleep mask is one of the most underrated tools out there because it's a cheap, effective way to bring consistency and make light a controlled variable that's often not going to be able to be controlled, right? Like it's not very expensive. And anywhere you go, you can create the same environment from a light perspective. And the other thing it does, especially in this day and age, is it's a psychological trigger to committing to going to sleep, right? So a lot of people are on their phones or watching TV. They never have a point where like your brain is triggered to be like, okay, I'm going to shut down. It is time to rest. I'm going to bed. And so for college athletes, especially, like not being able to be on Snapchat and just be on their phone till they pass out, like having that moment, they fall asleep so much faster and they create a routine. They don't realize literally like not being able to see is the reason it's creating the routine, but it creates this awesome routine and their consistency and how fast they fall asleep gets much, much better. So I think sleep mask is an awesome tool that's often overlooked.
I've tried the sleep mask a few times.
You got to get used to it.
Yeah, definitely get used to it. Like I can definitely tell, like you said, when I'm in bed and I put the sleep mask on, It is a mental cue for me. It's time to go to sleep.
Yeah.
So I no longer can reach over and grab my phone and check for a last minute email.
Right.
It's on. But I would wake up in the middle of the night.
It's all over the place.
And it's off.
Yeah.
The first couple of nights I used the mouth tape too, I woke up in the middle of the night and I ripped it off. Not even knowing it. I think I just woke up. Yeah. And I was like, what's on my mouth?
Yeah.
Took it off. Now I don't rip it off anymore.
Yeah.
But that took me some time to get used to.
Yeah, weirdly, the masks seem to take people a little longer to get used to than the mouth tape. But the mouth tape was truly life-changing for me. So like my personal experience with it, I've read a ton of stuff, and obviously we know nasal breathing is extremely powerful and the evolution of taping your mouth and just ensuring that's happening. But so I started doing it, just trying it out. First night I did it, Katie was like traveling and came home late, and she like got in the room and I had my mouth tape and she was like, what is happening?
Probably thought you were like being held hostage.
Yeah, no, for real. Yeah. And she was like three, it was like 3 years ago. So it wasn't like a well-known thing. She had no idea. So if that freaked her
what
out.
What do you do when I leave the house?
Yeah. Yeah. She was like, is there someone in the closet? Like what was going on here? But, so I started feeling like way better. I wake up, like I was more refreshed. I didn't wake up as often. I just felt like, you know, like you have an awesome night's sleep, like deep sleep. You feel like you're just coming out of a coma kind of when you wake up.
Yeah.
Like, that's how it felt like every night. Fast forward, like, you know, there wasn't a lot of great options for mouth tape, and I'm speaking and I'm recommending it, but you know, there's no brand that I feel really comfortable recommending. So we start Dream Recovery and I'm like, let's actually figure out like from a physiological perspective, what's going on. So I did two clinical sleep studies. I did one without the mouth tape, one with the mouth tape. Without the mouth tape, I stopped breathing 86 times throughout the night. I was diagnosed with moderate sleep apnea. They would recommend me to be on a CPAP, like the whole deal. And then I did it with the mouth tape and I had 8 disturbances the entire night, like less than average. You know, REM sleep was up like 50%. Deep sleep, slow wave sleep was up like 50%. Like everything fell into place. So it's no wonder I felt so much better. But the thing is like, I thought I slept well before. You know, I never had a problem sleeping. I thought I felt good. I thought I was getting like deep rest, and it was just like, you don't really know what you don't know. Like you've only slept as yourself your whole life. So you really don't have the perspective of change. Mm-hmm. So that's like one of the rare times with sleep, like you have this drastic change and you're able to feel the difference. So it kind of makes sense why it was so impactful for me. But there's a lot of people out there, like I was breathing through my mouth. Now I'm so aware of it that like, if I don't use it, like I have a dry mouth when I wake up and I realize that's happening, but I had no idea. And same with Katie. So we're quite the pair at night, you know, eye masks, mouth tape. We look like crazy people.
Yeah. The first time I ever tried it after you gave it to me, I put the mouth tape on and the eye mask, and Steph loves talking before we go to bed.
Yeah.
And I was just laying there. I could hear her talking to me, but I couldn't respond. So I just like put my hand like, stop. I was like, and I pointed. I was like,
yeah.
I got eye mask. Tape. I can't see or talk.
Yeah. Unbelievable, you know, anger management tool if there's an argument.
Yeah.
And it stops it instantaneously.
Well, I think it's definitely, for me at least, it was intimidating to overcome it first because I had this fear that it was going to be like a duct tape and I was going to take it off my lips in the morning and it was going to rip my my skin off with it. Yeah. But it's like a KT tape.
Yeah, it's similar. So it's similar like pliability. It's made out of like bamboo silk. And then the adhesive is, you know, meant to be on your skin that long. Like that's the biggest thing with a lot of these companies. They banned all mouth tape from Amazon because people were like breaking out because there's all these sketchy, you know, materials being used. So it's like medical grade adhesive that we ship from the US. And it's like a good combination. Obviously it's really secure, but you can take it off. It's not like gonna rip your skin off. And we're actually working on a really small vertical tape because a lot of people are nervous about it. You know, it is a weird thing, and to completely shut your mouth up, sometimes people have anxiety and like they're scared to try it. So we're coming out with like a smaller version that just subtly secures your mouth shut. And that's also great for people who maybe aren't sure like if they're breathing out of their mouth or their nose. And you'll be able to tell pretty quickly if that thing holds, like you're probably in a pretty good spot.
What is the benefit of breathing out of your nose as opposed to your mouth?
It's wild, you know. We're learning more and more, but you know, you're just one, you know, it's a direct link to your nervous system, you know? So to really get yourself in a place where your body's relaxing and you're calm and you're able to be restful, you almost have to be breathing out of your nose. If you're breathing out of your mouth, it's going to ramp your nervous system up. And, you know, our mouth is meant to be used for breathing when we need massive amounts of volume of air, right? Like when we're sprinting or running, whatever it may be, but our nose is more efficient, right? So with a lesser volume, we can take in more oxygen through our nose, right? It just relaxes your body in a whole nother way, just because the efficiency, it moistens the air. And it really allows you to fully, like from a physiological perspective, be at rest. Like it's about eliminating those stressors, and breathing out of your mouth is just another stressor your body has to deal with.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but there's the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system.
Yep.
And is it parasympathetic that is rest and digest?
Yeah, which is weird because you'd think sympathetic sounds more like restful.
Right.
But yeah.
And I think then sympathetic is like the active state, correct?
Yes, yes.
And when you're breathing through your nose, that activates the parasympathetic?
Correct. And that's kind of why, you know, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, it's weird to talk about, but erectile dysfunction has like skyrocketed. And that's because like in order to have that happen, you have to be in a parasympathetic state. Like you have to be calm. And then at the end, it's the opposite. It's a sympathetic state. You're hyper aroused and you know, your nervous system's fired up. So like just as a culture, you know, we're so stressed and constantly in this, you know, the elevated state of our nervous system that a lot of things like sleep and, you know, sex and things like that have taken the hit and people don't even realize it. And it kind of like stems across a lot of these different areas of our biology.
Are people now having sex with mouth tape on?
I think they've been doing that, but I think that's a whole different area. I don't know if that's I don't know if they're into quite the same thing. I don't think they're into health and performance. Different kind of performance, maybe. I don't know. That's
true.
Yeah.
Bondage.
Yeah, type. That's I don't know what you're into, but you know, I can get you some more tape if you need it.
The tape's been game changing, man, for sleep, because I naturally do breathe through my mouth.
I'd love to see a study on you.
I'd be so curious.
We should do one, at home one, because you it could be similar to me, you know, and men seem to have a higher rates of sleep apnea, especially with the size of their neck or if they're overweight, a lot of different issues. But yeah, if you feel that much better, I bet you had something going on.
Yeah. With Dream Recovery, are you guys not able to sell on Amazon?
No.
Man.
It's wild. But actually, you know what? It's actually been the best thing to happen because I think it's made people realize how important the quality of the, you know, the materials are. And also like people have to seek it out. So I think, some of those companies that were using all the sketchy stuff, they would just, you know, they're such a cheap product. They could just throw everything right back into the Amazon marketing. So I think it allowed us to actually like gain a platform because people had to actually go look for it and learn about it, as opposed to just like go after like the cheapest ones on there.
Have you been doing a lot of trial? Because it reminds me of a product that if you can get it in people's hands and they try it, they become a believer.
It's hard. Yeah. Yeah. We definitely love to give it to people and have people try it out. The hard thing though, it is, like you said, it's intimidating.
It is intimidating.
So one, it's intimidating. It's a little scary. It's not something people are like stoked to try. And two, it's, I don't know. I mean, that's the biggest thing. It's like, we love people to try it. And well, the second thing is like, people have to like really see it through. You know, you have to give it probably a week before you feel, I mean, I felt a difference right away. And actually a lot of people, you know, they feel good pretty quickly, but if you're already a little nervous about it, like it's going to take a while for you to adapt. So those are probably our two, you know, things we have to overcome. But
yeah, it's like I said, like I woke up those first couple nights and I woke up like, what's in my mouth? I just took it off.
Yeah.
But I just naturally stopped doing that.
Yeah. I'll still do that maybe a couple times a month where I wake up and I'm like, wait, what happened? And then it's like stuck to my like back or something like that.
So, right.
Yeah. It's definitely weird. Like we get messages all the time, you know, because people are so nervous about it. But I always recommend like, okay, put the tape on, go for a walk, or even just sit and watch TV and just, you know, basically prove to yourself you're going to be okay, because you're totally fine breathing out of your nose. And a lot of people have issues with congestion. And a lot of times actually breathing out of your mouth chronically makes the congestion worse, because your brain's interpreting that as like having, you know, CO2 levels that are requiring you to breathe through your mouth, and it causes more congestion. And so oftentimes people who actually have congestion, that's why they're nervous to use it. Once they teach themselves how to breathe through their nose, it alleviates the congestion.
Yeah, it's like the other night I was stuffed up and congested. You told me to use a mouth tape and it's not fine.
Did it clear it up?
I mean, I felt better, but like I thought that I wouldn't be able to even fall asleep, but I was able to fall asleep still and keep breathing through my nose.
Yeah.
But it was that I was trying to balance breathing through my mouth and nose when I was sick.
Mm-hmm.
That was making it more difficult.
Definitely. Yeah. It's counterintuitive, but it definitely works. And I used to wake up congested quite a bit and didn't realize why.
Yeah.
But we are developing some nasal strips, which will also help.
I can't wait to try that.
I'm super excited about it. Man, when I put them on, like night and day difference, it's crazy how good it feels. I'm excited from the performance perspective. I mean, there hasn't been that much research on stuff like that. So I want to do some like clinical stuff that really, I mean, if you're able to increase that volume, like by a fair share, it has to have a huge impact on performance and endurance.
Well, like I was telling you, I've never worn a nose strip before.
Mm-hmm.
And my left nostril is always, like, I can't get a full breath in my left nostril. I always can in my right nostril. And I was at the starting line of the marathon this past weekend at CIM. And Eric Floberg was there and he was putting on a nasal strip. And he was like, dude, you got to try this, put it on. So I put it on and it just like lifted my nostrils up a little bit. Instantly, I could smell things. I could pick up on every scent. I could smell people's colognes and deodorants and foods and like flowers. Like no bullshit. I could smell everything.
That's wild.
And I could take this massive deep breath. Now, I ended up taking it off before the marathon started.
You probably would have went 2:30.
I know. I should have kept it on. But I was nervous of trying something new. So even, you know, when we launched this marathon video, January 1st, like me at the starting line, you'll see I have this nasal strip on. But then when I go out, it's not on anymore. It's because I ripped it off.
Yeah.
Because I was just afraid. Like, you know, you get so superstitious about
I would not try it
competitions.
Either.
Like, I'm not trying something new.
Well, some of the sleep stuff, sometimes athletes will be like, oh, I have a huge meet this weekend. Like, what should I do, you know, to really make sure I sleep well? And I'm like, well, nothing now. Like, it needs to be part of your routine. You can't just like throw these different tools in there and expect it to work the first night. They only work if it's part of your consistent routine and you have to get used to things. So in competition, it's like, yeah, don't change things. Don't try things out during the competition.
It's
the worst thing you can do.
How do you incorporate the sauna around your sleep? Because traditionally when I use my sauna, we both have the Sisu.
Yeah,
saunas.
Pete's like the best guy ever.
Yeah, love Pete, love Sisu.
There's some great saunas out there, but like I just love Sisu because like Pete's such a good guy. Like, you know, they're going to do the right things and they treat people well. And I think that's like so important. You know, you can just tell.
You also want to see like good people win.
For sure. They're crushing too. So I'm super happy for him.
So I use my Sisu sauna typically the end of the night after we put Charlie down. 30 minutes to an hour before going to sleep.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you stay in 30 minutes to an hour. I was like, dang.
No. I'm doing like
badass in there.
I'm doing like 20 minutes right now.
Yeah.
200 degrees. And then you gave me those essential oils.
Mm-hmm.
I've been filling the pot with essential oils. Now I'll dump that on the rocks.
Yep.
That's game changing.
So good.
Dude, I'll just keep dumping water on those rocks.
Yeah.
And my sweat just pours out of my body.
Oh, that'll elevate the temperature real quick. Well, not the temperature, but humidity.
Instantly.
Yeah, so my night routine, I've kind of changed it up. I used to like go in there and like go until I couldn't do it anymore. But I found that, I think there's a point of diminishing returns with the temperature where I've done it where I think if you go too hot and you push it too hard, that it's a stress for your body and it can actually like prolong how long it takes you to fall asleep. So I think there's like a middle ground. So I've been going a little lower temperature. I'll do two rounds usually, lower temperature. So like maybe 185, but try to go a little longer, like 25 minutes. And that seems to work really well. If I can, I'll do two rounds. So I'll do 25 and I'll just dip in the cold or maybe like 30 seconds. And then I'll do another cycle and then dip in the cold again, but not in the cold too long where it like, you know, spikes my dopamine and all that stuff. And then I've been using lavender essential oils for the last cycle. So it's like a calming.
I'll have to try that.
Yeah. I got a bunch. Like I'll give you some.
So do you do another round of cycles earlier in the day?
I try to do cold plunge first thing in the morning by itself, which is brutal sometimes, but I feel awesome afterwards. It really like primes me for my day. It depends. If I'm going to do like run or something early in the morning, I usually don't do it before that. I'll do it after sometimes if it's a longer run or whatever it may be, just because it feels good when I'm super hot. But if I'm going to do my cardio a little later, I'll do cold plunge first thing. And then honestly, you know, I invite people over all the time to do like contrast stuff. So I kind of save that for like the social setting because it seems to be happening quite often. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just like a fun experience, you know? So I don't really use that as like I think that like just from a recovery or like optimization perspective, I think sauna and cold is actually better separated. So that's what I do if I'm by myself.
Okay. But, so you see, you'll do like cold in the morning.
Hot at night.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just do enough cold to like make me not like burning up when I get in the bedroom.
Yeah.
I actually love the hot tub for right before bed too, because, you know, water transfers energy so well. You know, I almost feel exhausted when I get out of the hot tub. So that's been a nice tool, especially when it's cold outside. It's super relaxing too, like psychological side. I really enjoy it. So mix it up.
Yeah, our cold plunge gets delivered at the end of this month.
Mm.
We got the Renew one.
Those are sick.
Super excited for that to get dropped off. And I honestly want to use the cold plunge and the sauna the same way you use it for like social settings.
It's awesome.
People come over, you do a few rounds, you have conversations, like a fire or something.
Yeah. And it's crazy because like, you know, it mimics a lot of the neuromodulator responses of alcohol. And it's a healthy, fun way to like be more social. Like it does make you want to be more social and create relationships and produce all the same chemicals that attract alcohol to people, and you feel great the next day. It's like the best of both worlds. So that's kind of how I use it, honestly. And sometimes, you know, I'll consciously do that where like we could either go grab some drinks on a Friday night or let's get a group of people together and go sauna. And maybe some people do have a couple of drinks after, whatever. But I think I just feel so much better when I make little changes like that. And I have, the other thing is you have such great conversations in the sauna. I mean, the first time you came over, I feel like we would have never had that depth of conversation if we weren't stuck in this sauna with no phones, like nothing else going on.
First time we met too.
Yeah. And it just forces you to like get to know somebody really fast. So I feel like in Nashville, I feel like 80% of my friends here I've met in the sauna the first time I met them.
Well, I mean, it's this small, like 6-foot by 5-foot box.
Yeah.
That's 200 plus degrees. You're both pretty much naked.
Yeah.
you get to know people something.
Real quick. Yeah. You're both naked. You have veins flying out of your arms, you know? And like, first time you came over, I was like, oh, this dude is getting after it. He's in good shape.
Yeah. Honestly, like the Sisu sauna has been one of my favorite additions to our house and just like my recovery and optimization protocol.
I think like, saunas are obviously a luxury. They're very expensive. It's a huge investment. But like, if you could get anything it's hard to argue against the sauna, because if you use it as a tool from like the social setting too, like you can get so much value out of that. And also you create this friend group that is doing the right things. Usually they're into the same things. Like they're healthy, but also trying to have a good time. Like, man, I would not trade my sauna for anything.
Yeah. I mean, I think back to when I was in high school or college.
Yeah.
Working out at Gold's Gym. There was a sauna there all the time. You'd hop in the sauna for like 5 to 10 minutes before a workout.
Yep. With your clothes. Like
with your clothes on. Yeah. And I always thought the sauna was just something to relax you and feel better, prime you for a workout. And, you know, you feel good leaving a sauna.
Yeah.
But with all the research that's actually out there about the use of sauna for dementia and preventing cognitive decline.
Yeah.
It's extensive.
It's wild.
So it's one of those things, like, yes, you feel good in the moment. You can use it for a social activator. But if you do it frequently and on a consistent basis, it can save your life years to come, at least save your mind.
Yeah, which is the most important thing. I mean, that's one of my biggest fears. I mean, I think everybody's been touched by, you know, Alzheimer's or dementia. It's horrible to witness. And I think that anything you can, well, the cool thing is with that is we're finding out more and more, a lot of those are environmental factors, and there's a lot of things you can do to prevent those diseases. But yeah, the sauna research is wild. Even from a mental health perspective, they've done studies where they expose people to heat one time and it reduces depression like symptoms for up to 6 weeks in double blind placebo studies, meaning like both groups thought they had heat exposure. Just
Dang.
One wasn't hot enough to raise their core temperature and one was. And so it was like one of the best studies you could do, and people report like a reduction in depression like symptoms, which is wild, you know. And like a lot of people, like, you know, it seems like it makes your endorphin receptors more sensitive. So some of those like positive emotions you're feeling, it just amplifies those positive emotions for an extended time. It's not like just while you're in there, like it seems to linger and you know, be something that stays with you, which is just awesome. Like, think about like interventions, like holistic interventions for mental health stuff. I mean, that's one of the best places to start. I mean, sleep and that, like, that's a pretty powerful duo.
Yeah. I remember when I used to do contrast stuff back in Texas. I would go between the cold plunge and the sauna. But if I did it, it was usually at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to bed shortly after. But when I visited you and we did it that day, I think it was probably like 1 p.m., 2 p.m., something mm-hmm. like that. And we did two rounds, hot and cold. I left your house feeling like I had 4 shots of espresso.
You were fired up.
I had so much energy.
Yeah.
That I went and bought a cold plunge right after.
I remember you were like, man, I forgot what this is like.
I had so much energy for the rest of the day that I didn't need my second dose of caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
I was good to power through.
Yeah.
It is so powerful for the body.
It is. And the mind. I think that's the thing is like, I think like cold and hot, like we always knew like, oh, I feel pretty good after like the sauna, like when you were at Gold's Gym, but we never knew why we felt good. Like there was never good data on what the actual response was. And now we're starting to figure out like, oh, it's not like a psychological thing where we're just convincing ourselves we feel good. Like this is doing pretty incredible stuff. And really all it is like, everyone talks about adversity, but it's pretty clear like all forms of adversity have a positive impact on us, mm-hmm. whether it be psychological, heat, cold, like all these different things. Like it just builds resilience in whatever bucket you're going after.
Yeah. The last thing I want to say about the sauna is it actually mimics the effects on the body, like a zone 2 cardiovascular workout.
Yeah.
Great for the heart, where it elevates core body temperature, elevates your heart rate to a place where you're almost getting the effects of a low intensity aerobic based workout. And I know a lot of people will go for their runs or do their endurance workout for the day,
mm-hmm.
and they'll go straight into the sauna afterwards to extend the effects on the body of that slightly increased heart rate.
Yeah. And there's some pretty good data on that for endurance runners and just like increasing on anaerobic output and red blood cell production by doing like right after you run or right after you do some type of cardiovascular exercise to jump in the sauna for 20 minutes.
And heat acclimation.
Definitely.
If you're doing a really big Ironman or marathon and it's in a climate or time of the year that's hotter temperatures,
mm-hmm.
using the sauna leading up to that race or that event can allow your body to acclimate to heat more efficiently. So that come race day, you're prepared to to be adaptable to that climate.
Yeah, I think it's a great way. Cause yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, a lot of people travel for stuff like that. So they might not be able to train in the same climate that they're going to compete in. And that's an awesome tool. And I also think that, you know, it does train your body how to cool itself down more efficiently. You know, when you first start doing sauna, it probably takes you, you'll notice if someone's new to the sauna, they won't start sweating as quickly as someone that's acclimated to the heat, because that's just how efficient your body is at cooling itself down. So the more I do it, the faster faster I break. Like you would call it, like, did you break yet? And start sweating. And that happens sooner and sooner. And I'll notice, like if I'm in a group of like 8 people, I'm sweating probably 4 times as much as people who don't do it very often, because I'm much more acclimated to that heat. And I think that probably transitions over to, like, even if you're not competing in heat, but you're competing at a cooler temperature, I think people feel amazing because they're so efficient. Like, you know, your temperature regulation is barely even a factor in a cooler climate because you're so efficient. Like you even sweat a little bit in that type of climate and you're golden. I think Katie experienced that in the New York City Marathon.
Yeah. And I noticed that actually when we moved from Austin to Nashville, because we had our Sisu sauna in Austin, and then we didn't have it for a few weeks once we got to Nashville. So there was a few week gap where I wasn't using the sauna on a regular basis. And then we finally got it set up. Pete came down and helped us set up the new one. I started using the sauna again every night. And one, it took me longer to sweat. Two, I couldn't stay in as long as I used to.
Yeah.
So I was breaking it, like breaking mentally and physically, like 12 minutes in, where I usually do 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be like, I got to get out of here, right? I turn the heat down. Now, as I'm back on a schedule, 20 minutes for me is almost easy again at the same temperature.
Yeah, you definitely get used to it. It's almost like in running, like you build yourself up, and it's like, you know, what's a great, like, you want to talk about like testing yourself mentally is setting like goals in the sauna. Sometimes with friends, like, you know, I have to have a friend that's like pretty into it, but, you know, picking a temperature and being like, all right, let's do 25 minutes. And you know you're okay, but it's a suffocating feeling.
It is suffocating.
And then just breathing through your nose and calming yourself down, like, it's a great tactic to learn how to like regulate your nervous system, because it's hard. Like, I don't know what it is, but that suffocating heat feeling is it's one of the more helpless feelings out there. It's way different than anything else. So I'll do that every once in a while. People are into it, and it's tough. It's really hard to calm yourself down when you're super hot. Sometimes my heart rate will get to like 150, 155. It's pretty gnarly.
Yeah, I start rocking back and forth.
Yeah.
Like trying to calm myself down. Or one of the things I'll do when I'm by myself is I'll set the temperature and then I won't look at my watch. And I'll try to go 20 minutes without looking at my watch and go as long as possible. I'm like, all right, I think I'm close. Look down, it's like
12 minutes.
Yeah. Like 9 minutes. Yeah. I'm like, holy shit.
No, dude, I feel like the time goes super slow when you do that. It's not easy to do by yourself. Say that for sure.
It's definitely easier with people.
Yeah, you get a conversation going, you can kind of psych yourself out of it to a certain point, and then it just goes silent. Everybody's just quiet for a while.
Yep.
So,
well, Todd, man, I honestly appreciate it.
This is great, man.
I've been loving all the content you put out about sleep optimization. Been loving the dream recovery products.
Appreciate it.
You influenced me to get back on the cold plunge train. Order that, like I said, the day after we did those contrasts. So I appreciate it, man. It's been great to get to know you, and the warm welcome into the city. Me and Steph both really appreciate you guys.
Oh, for sure, man. It's been awesome to get to know you guys, and you know, Steph's a Spartan, so I knew you had to be a pretty cool guy since, you know, she went to Michigan State, obviously.
Yeah.
But no, it's been great, man. And you know, watching all your stuff and kind of digging into more what you've been doing. It's really inspiring. It's cool to watch. It's making me get back on my run game a little bit.
I'm going to join you one of these times.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, Shelby Park is the best.
It's beautiful.
It's unbelievable. It's like you couldn't design a better running path.
Yeah. Nashville, what I found is big running community, super accessible to get to a lot of different places. And like the cherry on top is the food scene is just so good.
And wouldn't, I didn't expect that either.
No.
Dude, the food is like, I feel like there's so many restaurants and they're like very unique. You know, it's all spectrums. Like you wouldn't think, for example, like we went to NoCo, like you wouldn't think, oh, there's an amazing Asian fusion place in Nashville. You would never think it. It'd be like, oh, it's probably good for Nashville. It's like, no, these would hold up anywhere. And it's been incredible.
I saw Noco just received like some award recognition for, it was like a nationwide recognition for like one of the best restaurants of like 2023 really? Or something like that. Yeah, I mean, I was so impressed by it.
Dude, the customer service and they do it the right way. And it's, I don't know, you can just tell, you can feel it. Every time I go in there, it's the exact same experience. And they just like want to please people. And it's refreshing because I feel like a lot of places have lost that over the last, you know, 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. And that's probably why I go there so often.
Yeah, so, we'll be back.
Definitely. That Wagyu beef, man. We could have done probably three times.
Well, I mean, I was like 2 weeks down from the marathon, so I was like controlling myself. Now, dude reins are off.
Oh, man.
Let's go.
All right, let's go back. Sounds good.
All right.
We'll book it.
Todd, appreciate you, man.
You soon, man.